We're very happy to be here and to have the chance to talk with you today. We hope that many of you have read the op-ed that appeared in Sunday's Washington Post, co-authored by the chairman and vice chair of the 9/11 Commission, Tom Kaine and Lee Hamilton. In that piece, they asked the question, are we safer today? Their answer, our country is not safe enough. They said, we still lack a sense of urgency in the face of grave danger. That's what they said 6 years after the 9/11 attacks. There are so many issues to consider as we assess the threat we face 6 years after those attacks, and there's time this afternoon just to touch on only a few of them. I'll make some comments on Afghanistan, Pakistan, the WMD threat, and say a word on how Al-Qaeda has changed and how we've adapted to meet the change. My friend and colleague Chris Kojan will speak about the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, and public diplomacy. These are all huge, complex topics. We can only scratch the surface. And so we'd like to devote much of our time today to hearing from you and taking your questions. So now on to Afghanistan. In an interview just the other day, former Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld characterized Afghanistan as a, quote, great success, close quote. He cited the fact that the U.S. and coalition liberated 28 million Afghans. The country now has a president and functioning parliament. Some might say he's operating out there where the buses don't run. At a minimum, he's taking the glasses half full perspective. But even making allowances for that, I beg to differ. I think we're in trouble in Afghanistan. The security situation in Afghanistan over the past 2 years has definitely deteriorated. Those are the words of Afghan President Karzai, spoken at an early August 2007 interview when he was in the U.S. for a summit meeting with President Bush. One former national security official called it a diplomatic understatement. Karzai's regime recently had to contend with the crisis of 21 South Korean hostages being held by Taliban forces and daily confronts civilian killings, drug trafficking, and a resurgent Taliban. Karzai said that the United States has gotten nowhere in finding Osama bin Laden. Karzai also upset administration officials when he characterized Iran as a helper of Afghanistan rather than as a foe. Spring 2006 saw a major Taliban offensive against NATO forces, with the Taliban taking over villages, setting up roadblocks, and burning schools and hospitals. In the past year, there has been heavy fighting as Taliban forces and Al-Qaeda remnants, striking from their safe havens in Pakistan, have ramped up their attacks on coalition forces and the Afghan government. Fierce battles have taken place in Helmand province in the south, but also in Kapisa province to the northeast of Kabul. Suicide bombings are on the increase. The insurgents do not have the ability to overthrow the government or to defeat the coalition. In fact, they suffer many losses in each battle. They can't take over, but they can and do keep the government off balance. And their resiliency raises serious questions among the population as to whether the central government can protect them. The ongoing fighting has also worked to harm the U.S. image in Afghanistan. U.S. special forces have often called in air power to blast Taliban locations. Because Taliban forces take refuge in civilian compounds, this tactic has led to high levels of civilian deaths, fostering deep civilian resentment, especially in the south. There have been 300 civilian deaths in Helmand alone this year, with as many as 500 civilians killed throughout the country. Some 5,000 non-combatants have been killed since the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan in 2001. In May, 20 civilians were killed in a small Helmand village, while in April, 57 villagers were killed in a single battle, also in Helmand. Half were women and children. British commanders have criticized U.S. tactics, saying that they undermine efforts to win the allegiance of local populations. We can beat the Taliban on the ground, one British commander said, but we're losing the population. Agonized by the loss of loved ones, villagers have told reporters that many village men have run off to take up arms with the Taliban to get revenge against the Americans. One mullah dismisses Western construction aid. First they kill me, and then they rebuild my house. What is the point when I am dead and my son is dead? This is not of any worth to us, was quoted in the New York Times in August. Karzai has repeatedly asked the U.S. military for caution. U.S. commanders are emphasizing the need to avoid civilian casualties. The U.S. now has 23,500 troops in Afghanistan. Some governors of Afghan provinces are criticizing the central government for its inability to provide physical security, extend its authority, and provide good governance. The government can't deliver economic or political reform or reconstruction, they say. There are authority vacuums in remote parts of the country, vacuums that are filled by the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, or criminals. Despite the coalition's efforts since 2001 to eradicate poppy cultivation, Afghanistan now accounts for 95% of world poppy production used to make heroin. Narcotics trafficking profits are aiding the Taliban and the insurgency. The U.S. has given $14 billion in aid to Afghanistan since 2001, although some years have seen a significant drop in aid. Funding in fiscal year 2005 was $4.3 billion. This amount dropped 38% to $3.1 billion in fiscal year 2006. A RAND study has found that despite the USG's promises to launch a Marshall Plan for Afghanistan, the U.S. has given less assistance per capita to Afghanistan than it has to post-conflict Bosnia, Kosovo, or Haiti. Many Afghan governors appreciate the role of provincial reconstruction teams, but their work amounts to a drop in the bucket in the face of severe poverty and widespread lawlessness. Projects have gone unfinanced, and the U.S. has provided few agricultural experts in a country that is 80% agricultural. The last three EU ambassadors to Kabul have strongly argued for dramatic increases in funding. One characterized the failure to build the nation as a, quote, big mistake, close quote. The administration, perhaps seeing the relationship between the myriad of problems besetting Afghanistan and the failure to provide significant levels of reconstruction funding, has boosted aid sharply in 2007. Total aid will top $9 billion, which is twice the amount of any year since 2001. However, 80% of this funding is slated for security, military training, and drug eradication, the results of which have been deplorable, with only 20% allocated for reconstruction projects. Former NATO Commander General Jim Jones has called Afghanistan the symbolic epicenter of terrorism. If we don't succeed in Afghanistan, he said, you're sending a very clear message to the terrorist organizations that the U.S., the U.N., and 37 countries with troops on the ground can be defeated. And we are not succeeding in Afghanistan now, or perhaps more accurately, we appear to be in a holding pattern. The Afghan government is fragile. The Taliban and the Al-Qaeda are capable of maintaining a low-intensity insurgency, which is demoralizing the population and undermining the government, and the drug eradication program appears to be a colossal failure. Calling that a great success seems, well, a trifle Orwellian to me. On to Pakistan. In September 2006, Islamabad cut a deal with tribal chiefs in the federally administered tribal area of Fatah. The government would remove troops from the area if the chiefs ensured that the Taliban and Al-Qaeda did not stage cross-border attacks on coalition forces or the Karzai government in Afghanistan. President Musharraf presented this to the Bush administration as a major development. The tribal chiefs never honored the agreement. Under cover of it, Taliban and Al-Qaeda forces have dramatically increased the number of forays into Afghanistan. There were double the number of attacks this June as in June 2006. In fall 2006, General Jones testified before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that Taliban leadership operated openly from Quetta, a Pakistani border city that has long been a hotbed of Islamic militancy. Al-Qaeda built a stronghold that resembled what it had in Afghanistan before 9/11. It maintained temporary training camps, though of smaller size than previously, and easily moved terrorists, arms, and money across the border. Militants transited airports without government interference. The government's storming in early July of Islamabad's Red Mosque, which had been taken over by radical clerics and their followers, inflamed extremists and led to violent clashes in the border regions. In mid-July, 40 militants attacked a government checkpoint in Miram Shah, another border city. More than 300 insurgents were killed in July, and 200 government soldiers lost their lives in the same month. Just 2 weeks ago, the Taliban captured up to 100 Pakistani government forces. According to a press report yesterday, a 14-year-old Pakistani boy with TNT strapped to his chest blew up 18 people, including two police near Dera in northwestern Pakistan. 14-year-old boy, that's a diabolical menace that we're facing. According to the July 2007 National Intelligence Estimate, Al-Qaeda has rebuilt its strength and established safe havens in the tribal belt along the Afghanistan border. Extremists trained in the region have been behind terrorist plots in London and now in Germany. On the issuance of the NIE, Homeland Security Advisor Fran Townsend said, "Musharraf's plan hasn't worked for Pakistan, it hasn't worked for the United States." The intelligence community clearly believes that given the extremist resurgence, remote areas of Pakistan might again be used as a platform for attacks on our homeland. The U.S. now plans to shower $750 million on Pakistan's tribal areas over the next 5 years to win hearts and minds. But it may be impossible to oversee how the funds are used in an area so hostile and dangerous. The Pakistan Army now has 100,000 troops in the region attempting to clamp down on terrorists lodged there. On to weapons of mass destruction. Osama bin Laden from the mid-1990s onward tried to acquire nuclear weapons. The rogue Pakistani scientist and nuclear proliferator AQ Khan met with Al-Qaeda representatives interested in buying nuclear materials. Bin Laden obtained a Saudi cleric's justification for using a nuclear weapon against the West. Most U.S. counterterrorism experts believe it's not a question of if, but when, an attack on the homeland, possibly involving weapons of mass destruction and producing mass casualties, will take place. The recent NIE said al-Qaeda is committed to acquiring a weapon of mass destruction and using it. As if to reinforce these concerns, in early August, New York City experienced a scare when law enforcement officers responded and mobilized to respond to an unverified nuclear threat. President Bush has said we should do everything in our power to keep nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons out of terrorist hands. The 9/11 Commission called for a maximum effort to prevent terrorists from acquiring weapons of mass destruction. Yesterday, Tom Kaine and Lee Hamilton said that we're not doing nearly enough. The risk of nuclear weapons being used today is growing, not receding. Stockpiles of loosely guarded nuclear weapons materials are scattered around the world, offering inviting targets for theft or for sale. Because of an explosion of knowledge and information throughout the world, the know-how and expertise to build nuclear weapons is far more available. Terrorists are seeking nuclear weapons for the same reasons terrorists seized airplanes on 9/11, to use them to inflict on the world the greatest possible human suffering, economic loss, and geopolitical chaos. In March 2007, the General Accountability Office congressional investigators learned how easy it is to defeat our systems designed to defend us from a radiological attack. Going undercover, they set up a bogus company and obtained a license from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission that would have allowed them to buy the radioactive materials needed for a so-called dirty bomb. Just about as easy as cooking up a batch of chocolate chip cookies. A $1.2 billion program to deploy new radiation monitors to screen trucks, cars, and cargo containers for nuclear devices has been delayed by questions over whether DHS misled Congress about the effectiveness of the detectors. Each of the machines costs $377,000 and are advertised to be able to detect highly enriched uranium 95% of the time. A GAO audit, however, found that relevant DHS officials did not know if the detectors worked effectively. Reporters have also uncovered that the defensive system the USG has deployed to detect the entry of fissionable materials into the country is seriously flawed. Radioactive detectors give off many false alarms, and the entire system seems undependable. See an article entitled Unthinkable by Steve Call in The New Yorker, March 12, 2007. The reality is that neither the President nor the Congress has demonstrated committed and public leadership on this crucial issue. Programs exist, but the leadership spark is lacking. Securing nuclear weapons is still not at the top of the national agenda where it ought to be, and which is, as the 9/11 Commission clearly advocated, is precisely where it should be. Now, just a word or two about al-Qaeda today. So how has al-Qaeda changed? It's changed a lot. In early 2002, al-Qaeda, after the successful initial U.S. response, was in a coma, but it has changed. It is now a synthesis, a brand, a network, a movement, an identity. It continues to be a vicious, deadly enemy. It seeks sanctuaries from which to make its plans, train to execute them, and to use as launching pads to other parts of the world. Its command and control may now be decentralized and fragmented, but al-Qaeda, the ideology, wins adherence over the internet. The FBI says there are 5,500 websites worldwide exhorting Muslims to undertake violent jihad against the West. At the end of his time as DNI, John Negroponte told Congress, al-Qaeda's core leadership are resilient. They continue to plot attacks against our homeland and other targets with the objective of inflicting mass casualties, and they are cultivating stronger operational connections and relationships that radiate outward from their leaders' secure hideouts in Pakistan and to affiliates throughout the Middle East, North Africa, and Europe. Last spring, DNI Mike McConnell, speaking to the Senate Armed Services Committee, said senior leaders in al-Qaeda were rebuilding bases in Pakistan. He described the Afghanistan-Pakistan border area as a haven for al-Qaeda and as one of the most dangerous places in the world. Over the past several years, it has become clear that al-Qaeda and its extremist progeny have been transforming rapidly. European law enforcement and intelligence officials no longer have meaningful profiles of terrorists. If I had more time, I would describe that shift and people that are flocking to al-Qaeda. Many more women now, for example, have become terrorists and have signed on. And it's just very difficult for authorities to even have a workable profile in their minds. The Glasgow plot, just remember that physicians were involved in that. They turned out to be incompetent car bombers, but I think we should ask ourselves, as Lawrence Wright has pointed out recently, what if they had simply utilized their own scientific and medical training and in the areas in which they have real competence? What if, as Wright points out, they had reached into their medical bags? The German plot disrupted last week is very alarming. Two Germans were involved who were converts to Islam. There is a Turkish connection there as well. And we need to consider the ease with which they obtained enormous quantities of hydrogen peroxide, and on and on and on. Again, just listen to the NIE. The U.S. homeland confronts a persistent and evolving terrorist threat. Yes, Al-Qaeda is changing. Are we adapting to meet those changes? I think not nearly fast enough. We have had many, many institutional changes. Some have been significant. We haven't been attacked in 6 years, so there clearly has been some improvement. But for every step forward, it's possible to cite setbacks and things that haven't been done well by our agencies. Just deconstruct our defense budget. How much money is going for aircraft carriers these days and big weapon systems, all totally useless against Al-Qaeda and its ilk? How little is going to human intelligence? Has that been fixed? We don't really know. We'll only know through rigorous congressional oversight of the intelligence community. 4 years ago, then-Defense Secretary Rumsfeld famously asked his advisors, are we capturing, killing, or deterring and dissuading more terrorists every day than the madrasas and the radical clerics are recruiting, training, and deploying against us? That's a very hard-nosed question, one that we have to face up to. But I think, as importantly, we need to ask and answer, what are we doing to prevent radicalization in the first place? 6 years on, after our world changed, do we even understand what needs to be done?